Welcome to the first episode of our second season of OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. OncLive On Air is a podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both print and digital formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. OncLive is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Pasadena, California, for a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer. The meeting, which featured insight from experts from City of Hope, covered a wide array of topics, ranging from advances made in HER2-positive breast cancer to key trials in metastatic triple-negative disease to genomic assays used in hormone receptor-positive disease to axilla management. Pivotal data from the Phase 3 CATHERINE trial in early HER2-positive breast cancer, as well as smaller studies in the metastatic setting, are molding modern treatment models and leading to improved prognoses, said co-chair of the meeting, Joanne Mortimer, MD. Mortimer is the Associate Director for Education and Training at the Comprehensive Cancer Center, Baum Family Professor in Women's Cancers, Vice Chair and Professor in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics Research, and Director of the Women's Cancer Programs at City of Hope. She informed us that with the advent of several effective therapies, HER2-positive breast cancer is evolving into more of a chronic disease. Listen on to hear facets of treatment for patients with early and metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer.
Within the past 6 months, there's been a change in how we treat patients who have larger tumors and who get upfront neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So neoadjuvant chemotherapy generally includes a combination of pertuzumab and trastuzumab, and at the time of surgery, we previously continued trastuzumab with or without pertuzumab for a full year. With the results of the CATHERINE study that was presented in San Antonio and then subsequently published in the New England Journal, we've learned that the addition of postoperative T-DM1 for 4 cycles in any woman who has residual cancer at the time of surgery is associated with a prolonged disease-free survival. So that's an entirely practice-changing treatment. So the challenge right now is to figure out, is there a role for pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting? So the AFFINITY trial was a randomized trial of adjuvant trastuzumab and chemotherapy with or without pertuzumab. And unfortunately, when the study was designed, a large number of those women had negative nodes and so had a favorable outcome. In fact, most probably would be treated only with paclitaxel and trastuzumab right now. So there's sort of a bias of who was entered in the trial. But the results of the randomized study really did not show a significant advantage to the addition of pertuzumab to trastuzumab, except perhaps in the subset of patients who had positive lymph nodes. And so in a negative lymph node patient with a favorable outcome, the addition of pertuzumab is probably not needed in the adjuvant setting. I think, you know, we always talk about how breast cancer has become a chronic disease, and that certainly is true for estrogen-positive breast cancer, but it's become really even more true, perhaps, in the HER2-positive breast cancer patients where treatment is so incredibly effective. You know, one of the issues in HER2-positive breast cancer continues to be brain metastases, which do seem to be more common than some other subsets of breast cancer. And this continues to be a problem as women live longer with metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, that brain metastases become a component of the metastatic sites. And how we treat those women is probably changing as we get newer drugs. Certainly radiation and surgery are the mainstay of treatment for brain metastases, but often there are new brain metastases that occur in the setting of prior radiation or places that are, you know, inaccessible to radiation and surgery. And for those women, you know, there is some evidence that lapatinib has some activity, neratinib may have some activity. T-DM1 has been shown to cause regression of brain metastases in very small series. And I suppose the interesting area is with tucatinib, which is a HER2 small molecule that seems to have selective effects on the brain and may emerge as a drug which is beneficial in women with metastatic breast cancer, HER2 positive to the brain.
Subsequently, co-chair Laura Kruper, MD, MS, told us that refinements in surgical techniques and the use of neoadjuvant chemotherapy are leading surgeons away from aggressive management of the axilla with axillary lymph node dissection in women with node-positive and negative breast cancer. In our interview, Kruper, director of the Women's Center, chief of breast surgery service, and associate professor, Division of Surgical Oncology, Department of Surgery at City of Hope, shared insight into the current management of the axilla, advances that have been made, and outstanding questions that still need to be addressed with future research.
So I am talking about management of the axilla in the patient with breast cancer, and I've broken it down into two components. So what to do with the axilla and axillary nodes in a breast cancer patient who has surgery first versus a patient who has surgery after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So those are the two ways I've broken it down. In the surgery first, I'm talking about two things recently that have changed our practice. One of them would be the ACAZOG Z11 trial. So this actually originally came out in 2011, and it was looking at women with positive sentinel nodes with breast cancer and whether they could be spared an axillary node dissection and just watched. And so these were women who were randomized to either just the sentinel node only and having a positive sentinel node, or going on and having an axillary node dissection. So the results came out in 2011. It was pretty practice changing then. This is just to solidify that the results have not changed. There's no survival difference between the two groups. There's no regional recurrence difference between the two groups. So basically, women who are having a lumpectomy with a sentinel node, you don't need to remove the rest of their lymph nodes. So that saves a lot of women the risk of lymphedema. Then the second thing I talk about is something called the Society of Surgical Oncology Choosing Wisely guidelines. So each society, not just surgery, but also cardiology, GI, they were asked to come up with 5 guidelines that would minimize over-treatment or over-diagnosis, over-testing. And so one of them for breast cancer was for women over the age of 70 with hormonal positive breast cancers, not doing sentinel nodes at all, so not even examining the axilla. And the reason being, most these women are all going to get endocrine therapy or an anti-estrogen, and that is going to be their treatment. And these women tend to do well, and axillary recurrences are very rare, and there's data to support this. So that is the recommendation. So I've been doing less sentinel node biopsies in my women over the age of 70 with hormone-positive breast cancers. So in the second part of my talk, I talk about what to do after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And studies have shown that it's safe to do a sentinel node after neoadjuvant chemo in a node-negative woman. But what do you do with the node-positive woman? And so we've been, a lot of surgeons have been offering less, and if there is a what's called pathologic complete response in the lymph nodes, not doing a full axillary node dissection. But you need to make sure you can actually adequately sample the lymph nodes. So I talk about that, about targeted axillary dissections or ways to minimize getting a false negative result. But I think at some point, people are looking at this, is there even going to be a time when we don't do anything on the lymph nodes, no surgery? Will we be able to diagnose whether people have converted from node positive to node negative by chemotherapy? And will we be able to determine that with such things like liquid biopsies? So, I might be out of a job in 10 or 20 years, but we'll see. But yes, the goal is to try and minimize what we're doing. And then lastly, a little hot on the frontier is the question of robotic mastectomies. I'm going to confess, I myself have not tried it yet, although I'd like to, because part of the difficulty in doing a nipple-sparing mastectomy is you're trying to dissect out the entire breast and preserve the blood supply to the nipple and the skin through a tiny incision. And robotic surgery, the part of the benefit is that you can blow up a space and then see a lot better than you would if you were using retractors yourself. So that might be the next frontier.
Transitioning over to triple negative breast cancer was Yuan Wan, MD, PhD, an associate professor of breast oncology in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics at City of Hope. When she stopped by, she explained how, for the first time ever, options are available to this patient population. Immunotherapy, PARP inhibitors, and antibody drug conjugates have shown efficacy in those with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, and the area of PARP inhibitors and combination approaches continues to evolve. However, she added that enhanced genomic understanding and proper patient selection are necessary in order to determine the optimal use of these agents.
So I think today we focused on three areas. One is immune checkpoint inhibitor, and the first FDA-approved indication in metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. And the second area, which is still evolving, which is the PARP inhibitor and its potential combination. And now we do have two PARP inhibitors in metastatic germline mutated triple-negative breast cancer. And thirdly is a very much exciting evolving therapy may potentially gain FDA approval later this year and toward the future. So I felt as a medical oncologist, for the first time ever, we have options for our patients. So this is very, very exciting. So the efficacy of IMPASSION that we can quote and discuss with patients is really limited to the clinical trial data. But I think I understand, you know, the FDA approval did not limit to first line, maybe due to this is a huge area in need, and we have patients in reality we're seeing in clinic who may be beyond first line, and maybe they're PD-L1 positive and have high tumor mutation burden, and deprive them of the opportunity of getting this potential effective therapy is detrimental. So I think there is a huge need in real world setting. Maybe that's because of that. And the impact of this study is that it is the first time now we have this exciting combination, and especially I'm excited for those folks who had a 10% of complete response rate. Now, we yet to see the matured overall survival data, but I think it is beginning of an era, which is immunotherapy. And I think what's need to be done in the future is how do we turn those 59% of patients who didn't have PD-L1 expression, or how do we turn the immune negative, immune cold tumor into immune hot tumor? So I think it's the beginning, and now we're confident that we have the signal is there. We just need to do a better job in doing the better combination, select better patient population. So a big question for us is the BRCAness, or those tumor who may not carry the germline mutation, but they may have methylation level. So they may have hypermethylation, that the outcome of this is that the tumor would mimic a germline mutated people, and we have no reliable way to test them. I know Myriad has an assay called HRD, homologous recombination defect assay, and beyond that, there's also a recently arising marker such as RAD51, which is a beautiful, simple immunohistochemistry. If it works, it may be a functional readout of so-called BRCAness. So as a matter of fact, we're in the process of proposing such a study to expand the PARP inhibitor beyond the germline, because the germline is 10 to 20%, but BRCAness or HRD deficient tumors may be approximately 40 to 45%. So, you know, can we find out, you know, secure these biomarkers and then apply a de-escalating approach? They really didn't need huge dose of chemo. So we're in the dilemma. So for example, the Gepar-6-TOL study using escalated regimen, you have weekly carbo-taxol, then followed by epirubicin and cytoxin. So really these are called escalations, truly not de-escalation. Now we're adding Keytruda on top. So again, the dilemma here is that for those folks who already can achieve PCR with chemo, why do we want to subject them to a risk of lifetime immune toxicity? So I think, again, you know, we just need to do a better job, find out who they are, but it's not easy. I personally have, you know, trouble finding it out, yeah.
Next, we sat down with Scott Glazer, MD, Assistant Professor in the Department of Radiation Oncology and Radiation Oncologist at City of Hope. In our interview, Glazer walked us through how the role of radiotherapy has evolved over the years, eligibility criteria, and ways to minimize the burden of the approach. Listen on to hear more.
Today I was asked to give a talk on early stage breast cancer and the use of radiotherapy. My talk goes through the history of radiation for early stage breast cancer all the way back to the NSABP trials at the time of Bernie Fisher, B4 and B6, all the way through more modern studies looking at radiation dose and fractionation schedules, whether or not we need to treat all early stage breast cancer patients with radiation, or whether some women, such as the elderly with ER-positive tumors, could avoid radiation, as well as ways that we can minimize the burden of radiation, such as accelerated partial breast irradiation, whereby we can shorten the amount of time and the amount of volume of tissue that gets radiation treatments. Sure. So in my talk today, I'll go over the historical standard, which was 5 weeks of external radiation to the entire breast. That was what was done in the early NSABP trials, usually to a dose of 50 gray and 25 fractions. Then studies came out about doing lumpectomy cavity boost. There's two main ones, the French study and the URTC study. Those trials showed an additional local control benefit when giving boost treatment. That's typically an extra week or so of radiation. So the historical standard's about 6 weeks of radiation, 5 weeks to the entire breast, one more week of boost treatment either to the lumpectomy cavity or to the scar in cases of a mastectomy. Then the main trials looking at doing a shorter course of treatment are the Canadian trial, that's published by Whelan, looking at 16 fractions of radiation, or 42.5 gray in 16 fractions. And then the British studies, or the MRC trials, which did about the same, about 3 weeks of radiation versus 5 weeks. Both of those studies showed that the shorter courses of radiation were just as effective as far as cancer control rates, and when looked at on a whole, have a favorable toxicity profile as well. That led ASTRO to issue new consensus statement within the last year or year and a half, updating the guidelines for use of hypofractionation. It used to be that women who were younger or who had high-grade tumors may not have been as easily recommended to have a shorter course of radiation treatment, but now with the new guidelines, pretty much all women are recommended to have the shorter course of radiation treatment. I think there's questions still to be discerned. There's ways that we can do radiation better by appropriately selecting women who either don't need as much radiation or for whom radiation can be done in a easier manner, both decreasing toxicity as far as the actual treatment itself and the hassle of going through a treatment that's every day for many, many weeks.
Lastly, we were joined by Saya Lavasani, MD, MS, an assistant professor of clinical medicine in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutic Research at City of Hope, who shared how genomic assays are painting a clearer picture of which patients with hormone receptor positive disease can receive endocrine therapy alone or do require the addition of chemotherapy. In our interview, she discussed the application of genomic assays in the management of hormone receptor positive disease and highlighted ongoing research.
So in general, I'm going to talk about the genomic profiling or genomic platform. That would include Oncotype DX and also MammaPrint testing. My focus would be on Oncotype DX or 21 gene assay and the update for the Taylor X study that was actually reported in ASCO 2018 and was published at New England Journal of Medicine in 2018, and that basically showed that patients with Oncotype DX recurrence score of 11 to 25, they were randomized to receive endocrine therapy only endocrine therapy plus minus chemotherapy, and the outcome for both group was the same. So invasive disease-free survival was the primary endpoint, and there was no difference in invasive disease-free survival in both groups. For patients who were younger than age 50, they did slightly better with chemotherapy if their Oncotype DX was 21 to 25. And also from Oncotype DX recurrence score of 16 to 20, there was a slightly improvement. But in general, this study didn't show any benefit for adding chemotherapy to this patient population. I'm also going to talk about MINDACT study, which was MammaPrint, which was a study, a randomized controlled trial on MammaPrint testing. So these were patients who were clinically high risk, but they were genomically, they were low risk. The MammaPrint or 70 gene assay didn't show increased risk. And this patient population, they were randomized to receiving chemotherapy versus endocrine therapy plus minus chemo. No, sorry. They were randomized to receive endocrine therapy plus minus chemotherapy, and the result of this study didn't show any improvement in outcome for patients who received chemotherapy. So this would change the recommendation for almost 50% of patients, because they will fall into category of low clinical risk. High clinical risk and low genomic risk, and we can avoid chemotherapy in these patients. MINDACT study included node positive patients as well. So the study results, it applies to node positive patients too. There are definitely questions that they need to be answered for node positive patients. We don't know what to do regarding the Oncotype DX. We do have some retrospective data that supports Oncotype DX in patients who have 1, 2, 3 positive lymph nodes, but we are waiting for the results of the RxPonder study, which is SWOG-1007 study, and that is for patients who had Oncotype less than 25 and they were randomized to receive chemotherapy plus minus, you know, endocrine therapy plus minus chemo. And for those, we don't have the results for this study.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive on Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you would like to learn more about the recent progress made in breast cancer, consider registering for the August 1st State of the Science Summit in Long Island, New York. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on August 22nd in Miami, Florida, which will focus on advances made in lung cancer. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. And while you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive on Air.